Hello, I'm Dr. Nicole Keith, professor at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and the president of the American College of Sports Medicine. I'm excited to welcome all of you to the 10th Hilliard discussion sponsored by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M. I am pleased to be part of this effort by the Huffines Institute to bring science to the public and believe that these are the types of endeavors that the public should support and work to foster. With a new debate format this year, the HD10 is discussing important topics in how we determine what is scientific truth, which is a critical topic for the Huffines Institute, ACSM, and science in general. We hope that this event will give you insight about this much debated topic, and we look forward to your participation in the polls and discussions in this event. Again, we welcome you to this great event, and with that, we'll turn the program over to the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Thank you for joining us for the Hilliard Discussion 10. I'm Dr. Tim Lightfoot, the director of the Huffines Institute, and like ACSM President Dr. Keith said, we want to welcome you to the Hilliard Discussion sponsored by the Huffines Institute. The Hilliard Discussion is just a piece of the Huffines Institute's ongoing mission to encourage a dialogue between sports scientists, practitioners, and the public. And I hope that you enjoy it and learn a bit as well. We've got a lot of changes for this 10th Hilliard discussion, not the least of which we are all attending the event online and at night. But the most important format change is our change to a debate format. This type of format is a better representation of how scientific truths are settled on, a debate based on facts that we know. And there's no better topic to kick off this new format with than our topic, does the scientific literature inhibit scientific truth? Over the past year, we've all searched for as much scientific truth as we could find regarding the virus, the pandemic, vaccinations, symptoms, you name it. You may not have thought about it, but how our society decides something is scientifically truthful is a very important process. That process of determining scientific truth, especially with the wide accessibility of information on the internet, has been a huge topic of debate in our field of life sciences, especially in the last 10 years. Our two speakers are going to be debating some of the newer thoughts in the area, and I hope that this debate will help you think a bit more about where and how you get your scientific truth. While I'm anxious to get to our speakers, Dr. Andrew Young from the U.S. Army Research Institute of Environmental Medicine and Dr. Brian Nosek from the Center for Open Science and the University of Virginia, I do want to take a moment to let you know about our general format tonight. The order of presentation was determined via a coin toss last week in a meeting with the speakers. Now, each speaker will have 15 minutes to make their opening statement. Then each speaker will have 10 minutes to offer a rebuttal and further comments. At that point, we'll have 5 to 10 minute section where the speakers will answer questions from the audience. And at that point, you can use your question and answer button on your screen to submit questions. After the question and answer period, each speaker will have a 5 minute closing statement. I'll then conclude the debate and you'll be able to participate in the post-debate poll. Then we'll close out the webinar. And now, without further ado, let's get to our speakers. Our first speaker today, arguing the con side of the debate, is Dr. Andrew Young. Dr. Young is a research physiologist and former chief of the Military Nutrition Division at the U.S. Army Research Institute of Environmental Medicine, or USARIM. After retiring in January of 2014 from over 36 years of federal service as a scientist at USARIM, Dr. Young continues to serve as an advisor and subject matter expert in operational physiology to USARIM. Additionally, Dr. Young was the Floyd D. Gottwalt Jr. Visiting Professor in Leadership and Ethics at the Virginia Military Institute during the 2014-2015 academic year, where he taught human performance physiology and nutrition in the biology department. He earned a BS in biology and a commission in the U.S. Army at Virginia Military Institute, and a PhD in physiology at North Carolina State University, and then served in the U.S. Army with assignments at USARIM and at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. Dr. Young is a member of the American Physiological Society, a fellow of the American College of Sports Medicine, and the immediate past editor-in-chief of the American College of Sports Medicine's flagship scientific journal, Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise. Dr. Young?
Thank you, Tim. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I really appreciate the invitation tonight to come and discuss the question, does the scientific literature inhibit the scientific truth? And my position is no, it does not. The scientific literature definitely supports scientists pursuing scientific truth. Before we get going tonight, I want to advise you that any of the positions, opinions, and statements that I make tonight are entirely my own and don't reflect any endorsement or approval by the organizations that I'm affiliated with. And while I've served in many editorial roles for scientific journals, I have never been employed by or a paid consultant for any journal publisher. So I know that many of you in the audience this evening are not professional scientists, so I thought I'd put our question into a little bit of context and explain what the scientific literature actually is. Traditionally, research scientists share their findings with other scientists by publishing articles in scholarly journals. The editors of those journals recruit independent experts or peers to review the article submitted and attest to the scientific quality of the article before it's published. Individuals and libraries purchase subscription to read the journal and the articles therein. Now, scholarly scientific journals have been around for quite a while. The first one came on the scene in 1665. It was published by the British Royal Society and it was called Philosophical Transactions. The founding editor, Henry Oldenburg, is often attributed with being the person who first started the process of peer review that I described. And since 1665, the numbers of scientific journals that are out there have grown exponentially, and it's been estimated that since the beginning of the 21st century, 1,200 to 1,500 new scholarly refereed journals are launched every year. However, in the 1990s, with the growth of the internet and the onset of the open science movement, there began to be questions raised as to whether traditional journals were the best means for sharing author scientific findings. So I believe that they are, as I said in my position. The journals and their publishers do provide value to the scientific process. They provide value to the scientific readers. These are typically scientists who are looking for information to guide their research. And those scientists, they seek a trusted brand with a good reputation when they're looking for information and journals to provide it. The journals ensure selectivity, that is, validity and quality of the scientific content of the journal. They provide for editing that facilitates accurate communication. And they often provide context for the articles that they publish by publishing commentaries that accompany those articles, general editorials, and letters to the editor from other scientists concerning articles published. Journal publishers provide considerable value to the authors themselves by facilitating the dissemination of the author's research. That includes ensuring that the research is distributed and kept highly visible, both in print and online. They ensure that the article is discoverable when we do our searches. They amplify the message of the article to the public through public media releases and social networking. They ensure a permanent, durable version of record is archived forever. And very importantly, they ensure that the author receives proper credit for their contribution to the scientific literature, and they enable the use of the author's article to be tracked. And this is increasingly used in the evaluation of a scientist's professional accomplishments. And we're going to come back to that later on this evening. And then journal publishers provide value to research communities and the society at large by advancing sound science. They provide for accountability, ensuring that funding and conflict of interest are fully disclosed and that they ensure ethical standards are adhered to. Journals support professional societies and institutions, and they contribute to scientific thinking in the research community aimed at identifying scientific gaps and priorities for work and funding. Now, I've only hit a couple of what I consider to be the most important things that journals and publishers do, and there's considerably more. And if you're interested in taking a deeper dive, I highly recommend you take a look at Ken Anderson's blog on this topic, published in the Scholarly Kitchen. So if for the minute here, we just accept my premise that the journals and the publishers do provide value that's important to the scientific process, then the next most important logical question is, who pays for that value? Because everything has a cost. As I said, traditionally, readers and libraries pay for subscriptions that allow the readers to access the articles and read the content of journals. However, it's being increasingly recognized that that particular subscription model tends to be unfair to economically disadvantaged readers who don't have the funds to access the articles. Furthermore, funding organizations are increasingly mandating that the authors whose research is supported by those organizations publish their articles in journals which make them immediately and freely accessible by all readers upon publication. Of course, by all readers, they don't include those 40% of the global population that don't have internet access, but that's a separate question. Now, in order to achieve this open access that we want to get, there's a variety of models, and I'm not going to go into them in detail, but the most desirable of the open access models is referred to as gold open access. And in the gold open access model, the authors pay, or an organization supporting the author, pay an article processing charge to the journal in order to have the article published and made freely available immediately on publication. And the article processing charge is supposed to offset the loss of subscription revenue. However, the article processing charges, they shift the cost of publishing from the reader to the author. And philosophically, that seems to be against all the principles of capitalism in our society, where consumers normally pay producers for the products. Nevertheless, the APC models are here and probably here to stay at least for some time. Now, APCs can range anywhere from a relatively modest $3,000 or $4,000 per article for an article published in the Journal of Applied Physiology, all the way up to nearly $13,000 for an article published in one of the most selective and best reputation journal in the world, Nature Genetics. But it's important to keep in mind that the APCs themselves create disparities among the authors. High APCs can limit early career authors and authors from economically disadvantaged countries from publishing their work in these highly selective journals with high APCs, and this could conceivably harm their career. Furthermore, the APCs are only paid by authors whose articles are accepted to be published. The articles of authors who submit and are rejected, these authors get a free ride. They receive the reviews of their articles, which they can then use to rewrite and improve their article and submit it to another journal, but they don't have to pay for that review. And finally, there are some funding organizations who do pay the APCs on behalf of their authors. However, these funding organizations have set upper limits how much they're willing to pay, and that in turn disadvantages their authors because it doesn't allow them to publish in the journals that charge the very highest APCs and are the most well-respected and selective. So from that, we go on to the question is it possible to achieve open access that the open science movement wants without having the high APCs for authors. Well, one model that's been proposed is an author choice model. The author can just simply choose to pay that APC, whatever it is. Or alternatively, upon submission of their article, the authors can pay a submission fee to cover the costs of processing and reviewing the articles. And if the article is accepted for publication, then a publication fee is levied on the author, and the sum of the submission and publication fees should be less than the APC fee. I don't know if that model is actually been employed, but it's been suggested, and its economic viability is not proven. Just this year, PLOS Biology and PLOS Medicine have announced what they call a community action publishing model. And in this model, various research institutions pay a membership fee to join a journal community. And that fee allows the faculty of the research institution to publish their articles in the journals without paying an APC. And yet the articles are open access and freely accessible by all readers upon publication. And one interesting aspect of this community action model is that PLOS is capping the profit that they're taking at 10% after direct and indirect costs. And anything that they earn over and above that 10%, they're going to reinvest back into the model and have it used to offset and lower membership fees for the members going forward. The question of how this is going to work out and whether PLOS can generate enough revenue to stay in business has yet to be answered. And of course, our open science movement adherents have said, well, we can solve all of this simply by moving to preprint servers like bioarchives and totally replace scientific journals and publishing. So what are preprint servers, for those of you that aren't totally familiar? The preprint servers are simply an online archive or a repository where an author can post a draft of their scholarly paper that has not yet been peer-reviewed or accepted by traditional academic journals. Typically, the authors retain the copyright, but the type of copyright usually permits free non-commercial use and reproduction by users as long as the original author of the intellectual property is attributed. Now, preprint servers do indeed enable authors to post their draft manuscripts in an openly accessible platform before the peer review process can be completed. And that in turn may allow the researchers to disseminate their work more quickly to colleagues and receive feedback quicker than the peer-reviewed process in the journals allows. And that in turn may allow the author to ensure they're properly credited for their contributions and that they perhaps receive credit for their productivity. However, some preprint servers will actually transfer the manuscript files directly to the journals when the author's ready to submit their paper to the traditional journal. Currently, preprint servers are supported by grants, and therefore they're fee-free to authors, but the sustainability of this model is really not known. Now, preprint servers have a number of unintended consequences. For one, they may contribute to the proliferation of shoddy research. For example, the preprint that I list on the screen here claims to show an association between the consumption of vegetables and COVID-19 mortality at a country level in Europe. However, when we go in and read the article carefully, what we find is there's numerous methodological flaws and particularly statistical analytical flaws that really make their conclusions pretty bogus. And in fact, Ken Anderson has estimated that over 30% of the papers that are posted on preprint servers are never accepted for publications by traditional journals, and they're simply abandoned on the servers. And furthermore, the actual preprint servers, they have each article post a disclaimer statement, which disclaims any responsibility for the server for the bad science they publish or its consequences. Preprint servers can also contribute to misleading the public by disseminating unvetted scientific findings. More and more, the mainstream media is scouring preprint servers for new research findings. And this has been especially the case during the pandemic, when the preprint servers are posting numerous non-peer-reviewed studies that have been done on various remedies and treatments for the coronavirus. And many examples of research have been reported in the mainstream media, which are subsequently unconfirmed. And that leads to a basic growth of distrust in science in general. There are a number of other issues. As I said, many of the preprints are never published in regular journals. Authors game the system by publishing redundant postings of the same manuscript with a simple tweak in the title. Preprint alt metrics can be manipulated much more easily than journal citation metrics, and hiring, promotion, tenure, grant application review committees, they typically don't value preprint alt metrics as highly as journal citation metrics. And as I've said several times, there's no peer review of preprint articles to ensure their accuracy and content. So let me just wrap up this section by restating my position. The scientific literature does not inhibit the scientific truth. Journals and their publishers do provide significant value to the scientific process, and preprint servers don't replicate that value. Journals and their publishers ought to adopt and promote many of the goals of the open science movement. And going forward, our key issue for the journals and publishers is how to design a business model that supports the open science while still fairly allocating the cost of delivering this science among all the stakeholders. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Young. Our second speaker today arguing the pro side of the debate is Dr. Brian Nosek. Dr. Nosek is the co-founder and executive director of the Center for Open Science, that operates the Open Science Framework, a collaborative management service for registering studies and archiving and sharing research materials and data. Dr. Nosek is also a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Virginia. He received his PhD from Yale University in 2002. He co-founded Project Implicit, a multi-university collaboration for research and education investigating implicit cognition, thoughts and feelings that occur outside of awareness or control. Dr. Nosek investigates the gap between values and practices, such as when behavior is influenced by factors other than one's intentions and goals. Research applications of this interest include implicit bias, decision-making, attitudes, ideology, morality, innovation, barriers to change, open science, and reproducibility. In 2015, he was named one of Nature's 10 and to the Chronicle for Higher Education's Influence List. So welcome to the stage, Dr. Nosek.
Thank you very much for the invitation to be part of this. I'm delighted to be involved in this discussion. My role today is the doom and gloom part of the positions between in this debate, particularly on the question of does the scientific literature inhibit scientific truth, or a rephrasing for my purposes, do publishing practices create unnecessary friction in knowledge building? My position is yes. So while I hope we will get into the positive side of things improving and changing and opportunities for solutions, I'm not going to talk about solutions now. Instead, I want to make two key points. The first is that the publishing system incentivizes practices that reduce the credibility of findings. It is not saying zero credibility of the published literature. Rather, we have created a structure and a system that makes it harder to evaluate the credibility of findings. And those that do get into the published literature have lower credibility than what we would intend or desire. And the second key point is that the publishing system is unnecessarily inefficient at self-correction. Self-correction is a hallmark of what makes science science. We're constantly interrogating the quality of evidence to find the errors and then improve our understanding of the things that we investigate. And science does do that, but it does so much more slowly, much more inefficiently because of the structure and system of publishing that we have established and we could do better at. Okay. So the first issue, what gets published? Publishing is a really important part of understanding this problem because publication is the currency of advancement for researchers. For me to have a job, for me to advance in my career, I need to publish. And not everything that I do in research gets published. Some things are more likely to get published than others. I'm more likely to get published if I have a positive result. These things are related. This treatment did, in fact, impact the outcome rather than negative results. This didn't work. These things aren't related. I'm more likely to get published finding novel results. Here's something new people haven't considered before, rather than trying to replicate and increase our confidence in prior results, earlier claims that others might have made. And I'm more likely to get published if each of the things that I do fits together in a nice, tidy ball of evidence to support the claims that I make about the things that I'm studying, rather than having parts that don't quite fit or things that I don't understand or areas that are unknown. And so a positive, novel, tidy story is the best kind of story in science. It's amazing when we get that. The problem is that that doesn't happen very often. It doesn't happen very often because researchers are studying things we don't understand. That's why we study them. And so progress is halting. It's slow. It's uncertain. There's lots of mess. There's lots of dead ends. There's lots of occasions where the things that we're investigating don't quite turn out the way that we would idealize in just discovering things fast, explaining them well, and moving on. And this is at the root of the challenge, because if most of the research I'm doing doesn't proceed in what's likely to get published, then I have an incentives problem. What I need to advance in my career isn't necessarily what I'm getting out of the research that I'm doing. And so what happens is that we have created a system where we indirectly, unintentionally reduce the credibility of the published literature. So imagine on the left is 100 separate studies all about a phenomenon that we're interested in, right? Does exercise increase longevity? Lots of different approaches to investigating it and lots of uncertainty in that investigation, right? Lots of opportunities to leverage chance to find perhaps it does or perhaps it doesn't, perhaps it even makes things worse. And each investigation will find different results. And what we would think in terms of advancement is understanding the totality of that evidence in order to understand the consequences for the research question that we have. So what you're seeing on the left is this imagined scenario where 30 of the studies find positive evidence. Increased exercise improves longevity. And 70 find negative results in all the different ways that they did it. But because of those incentives, we might create a situation where people themselves and then the peer review process itself encourages selective reporting, meaning that it discourages those studies that found negative results, that found messy results, from getting into the published literature at all. And so what we might get on the right is that most or all of the positive results get published. Those are exciting and interesting and publishable. And many fewer of the negative results get published. So what we see in the literature looks better for the hypothesis, looks like stronger evidence than the reality of the evidence of what we actually did and found. And then there's a second problem. And the second problem is that I have lots of choices that I can make as I analyze the data that might increase the likelihood of observing a positive result. Oh, it worked, rather than a negative one. These are collectively called p-hacking, right? I analyze the data multiple ways. Some of those ways leverage chance to reveal positive results. Others don't reveal positive results. And if I'm doing that, even unintentionally, in how I'm analyzing my data, just trying to make sense of it, and I see a positive result and I start to think, oh yeah, that's probably the right way to analyze this data, it's probably the right way to report it, then I may convert what were negative results into positive results because of this p-hacking, the different ways I analyze the data and overfit the findings, even further exaggerating what appears in the literature against what is reality. So those are not just in theory. There's now accumulated evidence that both of these things happen in practice and happen in practice regularly. This is one example. This research team took dissertations from researchers who were trying to get their PhDs, and they report in their dissertations all of their research. And then they compare those dissertations with the publication that came later after they tried to write up those results for publishing, went through peer review, and ultimately got published. What you see on the left is that what they found that in those dissertations, 45% of the hypotheses that were tested were positive results. When they went to that same studies, but now looked at the publication, what appeared in the literature, 67% of the hypotheses were positive results. Same research. What happened between what was examined versus what was published? Well, they dug further into those hypotheses and they compared the dissertation in the same paper, same research in the paper. And they found that the researchers had removed more than 1,300 of the hypotheses that they tested. They added 333, and the outcomes actually changed for the same hypothesis from negative to positive, mostly for 73 of them. So the process of actually preparing the research for publication led to the beautifying of the research, but misleading about the quality of that research. Second piece of evidence that we know that this is happening is this self-reported behavior. Researchers themselves, when you ask them, do you do these things that might reduce the quality and credibility of your findings? Researchers often say, yeah, I've done that thing. I fail to report all outcome measures. I analyze I have four different outcomes for assessing longevity, how long you live, your health, your reported well-being, right? How many diseases you have or something. And it only get the positive result for one of them. That's the one I report. That's not so good, right? I decide whether to continue collecting data after I look and see, did I get the result I want? Oh, not quite yet. Let's collect a little more and see if I get it, right? Increasing the likelihood of them leveraging chance. So these are a variety of different behaviors that reduce credibility, and researchers report doing them by and large because of that incentive system that is created by how we do publishing. Okay, so that's bad, but maybe on the second point, we can count on self-correction, right? Yeah, bad stuff's getting into literature. Yeah, we have bad incentives on that side, but we have peer review. And then we have all these processes after peer review to help improve the literature over time. It's not working the way it needs to, and it needs to work better. And I want to give a dramatic example of that. But first, just remind us, what gets in the way of self-correction? Well, if the literature has a false result that's already in the literature, what do I do as a researcher to be skeptical, to challenge that result? Do I do my own research, repeating it, and then try to publish my replications? Well, the incentives are against that. Don't bother doing replications, those are hard to publish. If the literature is already more exaggerated and more positive than reality, the research that I do challenging it is going to be more negative and more messy. That's harder to publish. So we've stacked the deck of once something gets in, all of the things that might challenge it and change our view are hard to also get in to compete with the stuff that's already in there and already looks more amazing than what is reality. But this is really hard. And so one more example before I say the really hard. We see the evidence of this occurring. Replications are rare, but when they're actually done by these groups that have organized to say, we're gonna try to replicate a sample of studies just to assess whether they are as credible as we would presume they are, what we observe is that they frequently fail to replicate published findings, even with very good faith and very highly diagnostic tests. Of this 307 systematic or many labs replication studies, where they take a finding and run it in many different places to get very strong estimates, only 64% are positive outcomes, whereas the originals, about 100% were positive outcomes. And the effect sizes, how strong the effect is, how large it is, of the relationship between the variables showed decline as well. Okay, so this is the point about how hard it is to self-correct. Here is a situation where self-correction should be unambiguous. These researchers found 311 articles that had been retracted from the literature because there was something wrong with the paper's conclusions, right? The methodology was wrong. It was fraudulent. There was no ambiguity that these findings were not credible. They should not be trusted. And so the paper was withdrawn from the literature. So what should happen in that scenario? Well, obviously, the research community should stop using it. They wouldn't cite it anymore. They wouldn't use it as a basis of evidence for the things that they are now trying to build on that work. Well, as I mentioned, all of these articles had been retracted by October 2014, either a month to years prior to that. What you see on the y-axis is the number of times those 311 papers had been cited cumulatively prior to October 2014. What should happen after that date? They're retracted, they shouldn't be cited. But you can see that each time these researchers assessed, there were more citations of those retracted papers, even though they were now out of the literature. Now, it would be fine if what they were citing those papers for was to say, this paper isn't trustworthy, citation of that paper. And that's not what they were doing. They were just citing the paper as evidence about whatever topic they were investigating. So even the most dramatic action, retraction, which happens extremely rarely, we still see influence of things that once they get into the literature, they keep impacting how research community moves forward. So the wealth of literature, it's not retracted, but just not as credible as we think, has no way that could even get close to standing up to that. So to conclude, the real challenge is what many people refer to as Brandolini's law. The amount of energy needed to refute bullshit is an order of magnitude larger than to produce it. And the system is not helping in how it is we evaluate and decide what's worthy of publication or not. Thanks very much for your time and attention.
So thank you, as I said, to Dr. Nosek for the opening statements and Dr. Young previously. At this point, we're going to turn the mics back over to the speakers for a 10-minute rebuttal and response to what they've heard so far. We'll go in the same order that we went in before. So first up is Dr. Young.
Okay. So I think that I'd like to dive into a couple of the things that we were hearing from Brian, and I kind of wanted to focus on the growth in the scientific literature and the use of citation metrics, do they really inhibit the truth? And if so, how might this inhibition be mitigated? And as I pointed out earlier, there's a huge increase every year in the amount of scientific literature. These two panels simply show the growth of scientific articles in a number of different databases from 1970 to 2006. And the number of articles appearing are increasing exponentially. At the same time, the number of STEM scientists, at least in the United States, and I believe worldwide, is greatly increasing. The biggest increases are seen in mathematical and computer occupations, but life sciences are growing rather rapidly here in the United States. But at the same time, our research funding and employment availability aren't keeping pace with the increase in the number of STEM scientists. And that's creating a tension or a competition, as it were, and Brian recognized that all the scientists need to publish quite a bit. And that's given rise to the use of these citation metrics so that scientists can find out what the best journal to publish in is. In fact, it's important to keep in mind that when the journal impact factor, which is the most widely used metric of how much a journal is being cited, when he introduced it, the intent was for this factor to be used by librarians in order to inform their decisions about which journal subscriptions to pay for. But that's migrated now, and these impact factors are being used to judge the quality of the journals the individual researchers are publishing in, along with a companion index that's very closely related called the H index. And again, these indexes weren't originally intended to use to grade individuals. And they're being misused in that regard, I believe. And I think that Brian very nicely pointed out that the model of producing or publishing and parsing surely does incentivize quantity over quality. And particularly if we're using citation metrics like the impact factor as a sole evaluation tool to judge a researcher's scientific contribution. The citation metrics are not are still useful, however. They provide us insights into how the scientific community rates the quality, significance, and importance of a research journal. And we believe that in terms of evaluating journals and researchers, we should use citation metrics along with other complementary tools for evaluation. First and foremost, when you're evaluating an article, you got to read it. When you're evaluating a researcher's contribution, you should read that researcher's scholarly output. You should read what he's actually writing about. Along with that, we have special other index tools, metrics that we can use. Altmetrics to evaluate the online impact, which is an indicator of lay interest. There's something called an M index that we can use to evaluate the researchers' mentoring abilities, how they bring up younger scientists. And there's even a data index that allows us to rate whether or not a scientist who contributes a large amount of data to an accessible database and whether that database is actually cited in good studies. So there's a lot we can do to improve the what we're getting out of our citation metrics, both for judging journals and for judging scientists. Now, the other thing Brian pointed out to was the impact of researchers p-hacking and what they're trying to do. And the fact is that journals actually do prioritize, most traditional journals, prioritize importance and novelty of the research, just like Brian said. In fact, we specifically direct in our reviewer forms that the reviewers rate the importance and novelty highly and tell us what they think. They're instructed that if they cannot rate a journal article in the top 25% of all articles on that topic, then they should not make any recommendation for revision or acceptance. And he's right. O'Brien is absolutely correct that articles reporting null effects or simply replicating previously reported findings often get rejected. However, we can get around that. We can improve that as journal publishers. We can make, first and foremost, I believe, we need to make our journal peer review processes more transparent, constructive, and rapid. I believe we need to go to an open review where reviewers and authors know each other and they actually work in a more collegial fashion. We need to open up things to post-publication review so that readers can comment and review. We need to publish rejected abstracts with a summary of the review so people know what's not getting published. We need to teach reviewers how to review when they're early in their careers. And I believe we need to compensate reviewers for submitting a high quality and timely review that helps us improve the paper. I believe also to combat publication bias, journals should adopt what the open science movement has started, called the registered report. And this is simply a type of article wherein the author submits the introduction and methods of their research paper before they even begin collecting any research data. If the paper is reviewed and the editor approves it for publication, then the researchers go back and do the research. They write up the results and discussion. And as long as they stuck to those methods they originally said they would use, that article is going to be published regardless of whether the findings are null or whether they're boring or untidy, as Brian calls it. I believe the journal should also encourage submission of replication papers that aim to reproduce findings not yet adequately reproduced. And we can do that with calls for papers. So Brian's pointed out a number of areas where we can definitely improve what we're doing in the journal side. And I still believe that that the scientific literature does increase, the journal publishers does increase the value add to the scientific literature. And I think that the scientific literature ensures high quality contact period for target audiences and so on. We can do a better job though. I believe the citation metrics do provide some useful information regarding the impact and quality of content in journals, but they should not be used as the sole evaluation tool for hiring, promotion, or grant awards. Journals, we do need to do better with our journal peer reviews, faster, more transparent, and we've got to adopt the countermeasures to mitigate publication bias. And finally, I believe the journal publishers should offer data repository and sharing systems for the authors of the articles that are published in that journal. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Young. We're going to turn this over to Dr. Nosek for his response and rebuttal.
Great. Thank you. There was a lot of great comments that Andy made, and I don't want to spend time on the areas of agreement because that's not the point of a debate. But his the issues he raised about addressing publication bias, I think, are all steps that are consistent with the things that I and many others in the open science movement think about. How to address those points. So let me zoom in on a few areas where I think there's some room for disagreement and discussion. Quality of peer review relating to the growth of research output and mechanisms to address that, and then some citation metrics. So there have been a few different studies that have examined the quality of peer review. And when we think about peer review, we think, oh, well, since journals have been invented, right, the peer review has been a part of that. Journals, the first journal started in 1665. Peer review started in, external peer review started in the 1950s and 60s. Nature, one of the top journals, actually started its peer review process in 1967, this practice of getting independent experts. Prior to that, it was the editors that would read the paper, say, yep, this is good for our journal, and they would decide to publish it or not. The process of peer review didn't emerge through a sophisticated investigation of what's the best way for us to vet papers in terms of evaluating their accuracy. It emerged as an ad hoc solution to figure out how is it that we can engage people who have some expertise in this area to decide whether this is credible work. And what has emerged as the standard for that is that you will send the paper out to 2 to 5 reviewers, usually, get their comments, and then make a summary judgment across those comments. And I think Andy raised a number of things of potential for improving that process. But the investigations that have been done on the reliability and validity of that process have disquieting results. The studies tend to show very low inter-rater reliability across reviewers in the quality and acceptability of articles. In fact, there have been a number of remarks that saying if researchers wrote up the peer review process as a measure and submitted it to a journal for publication, it would get rejected because of its unreliability. So the system itself is not a particularly good system for determining quality, reliability, and credibility. And that is fundamentally important for that earlier discussion that Andy raised about the distinction between preprints and published articles. Preprints are unvetted. They have not been evaluated by independent experts. They're shared to accelerate the dissemination of information and to encourage that vetting in an open context. Publications, by and large, have been peer-reviewed by a few ad hoc selected individuals and deemed worthy of being published in that journal. The fact that peer review has occurred does not tell you if you can trust the results or not. It is an indicator, it is a positive indicator that those individuals read it and thought highly enough of it to accept it. But it is a very imperfect indicator. And in fact, it's so imperfect that many consider it to be unreliable. In indicating anything about quality. Instead, many are arguing that it indicates something about potential for impact. or excitement or all those factors that I discussed at the early points of the things that researchers are selecting for. So one thought, because of the growth of the literature, as Andy correctly pointed out, occurring very rapidly, is how do we address it? Do we improve the gatekeeping? We should disallow things that are unreliable from getting through. So we need to improve the peer review and stop the bad research from getting out. That is one possibility, but I think it's the wrong answer. The reason that I think it's the wrong answer is because it doesn't change anything about the core incentives of I need that publication. And the higher and higher the bar I need to cross in order to get through, I will find ways to get over that bar. And not all of those ways are going to be improving the credibility of the research. And that doesn't mean I'm trying to lie. It means that I am affected by this incredible frontal lobe I have to help me rationalize these decisions that I make for how I present my research and then present it to the journal for evaluation. And the peer reviewers are in a disadvantaged context because they can't see the entire history of the work. They don't know all of those decisions, all the things that got left out. What they have is my presentation of my research. And I have skin in the game there. And that's too much to expect for the system to be able ultimately to have a gatekeeping function to solve it. So I think the solution is, in fact, to remove the gate, to make preprints the norm, to make everything openly accessible from the outset, so that we separate publication from evaluation. The core problem is that these two things are considered the same thing in the traditional system. In order for me to be published, I have to pass peer review. Once we separate them, then publication is no longer the goal. Instead, actually getting credible review, getting other experts to evaluate my work is in my interest rather than inhibiting me from my goal, which is to get the publication. And if we can cultivate an open review process that's focused on evaluation and not decisions about whether someone gets to see it or not, then we will cultivate a broader community-based approach to review that is sensitive to the fact that we know all the information is uncertain. And once we put a stamp of published, that makes it very difficult to reduce that credibility because of the persistence in the literature. I'll stop there. Oh, I didn't talk about citation metrics, but I'll stop. I think I've spoken long enough.
Brian, you've still got 4 minutes if you
want. I do. Oh yeah, my absolutely. Gosh. I'm going to say stuff about citation metrics. That's great. Yeah. I think that there is room for citation metrics to be used. So I am not a stalwart of the under no conditions do citations give you information that's useful. But I think they are more limited than what Andy presented. I think they are an indicator of citation impact, how much attention that articles get from other articles. And that's not zero information. That is useful information. Some things get more attention for positive or for negative reasons. And it's useful to know that. What I don't think the evidence supports at all, as far as I know, is that citations indicate quality. Things can be very highly cited and extremely low quality. Things can be almost never cited, in fact, never cited, and be extremely high quality. Citation impact is influenced by the size of the field, the controversial nature of the finding, and who it impacts, that finding. So researchers who work in a very small domain, who have only a few other researchers who are working on the problem that they're working on, may accumulate 5 or 6 or 7 citations, and that's it, from the most outstanding work that you would ever see. Whereas researchers that are doing something that has cross-field application and is willing to make outrageous claims that people have to respond to can get massive citations. And the other problem with the citation metrics is that they create the bad incentives for the journals. So journals are evaluated based on how much the articles in their journals are cited. So what does that create a selection pressure for? It creates a selection pressure not for credibility, but for exciting, seemingly important, going to be impactful. And that pulls the journal to start to pick articles that are going to be controversial, that are actually less likely to be true because they will generate the swarms of engagement and interest because people say, that's incredible. I can't believe that happened, because it didn't actually happen. But they have to now follow up on it because it's in nature, or it's in science, or it's in cell. Okay, I think I used my 4 minutes now. Thank you.
So I want to thank both of the speakers for their rebuttals in this case. We are going to open up the question and answer forum. If you have got questions that you'd like to pose to the two panelists, please go to the question and answer box and hit that. I'm going to start us off with a question for both of you. I think probably more Brian than Dr. Young. My concern with the pre-review servers or pre-print archives, whatever terminology you want to use, is that it's relatively easy for people to put fraudulent literature in there to advance a point of view. Wired Magazine that last month did an interesting article on how the world ran towards hydroxychloroquine very early. And the first article that actually proposed the use against COVID-19 was published in a preprint server, I think on March 13th, as a matter of fact. So how do we prevent, and that article was, we'll say, not up to snuff, but had been written by some folks that weren't scientists. How do we prevent the pre-review literature from becoming stuffed with articles that are written from a political or a non-scientific standpoint?
It's a great question, and the answer is we don't. Mm. We don't prevent it. And here's the rub, that compared to what is the key question. The published literature is also easy to get fraudulent work into it. It is not hard. It happens all of the time, and the peer review system is not prepared to prevent it, because there are effective and easy ways to commit fraud, and unreliable research, even the worst research, if a researcher is determined enough, they will get it into a peer review journal. Because many journals are just very happy to get submissions. Many times the peer review process itself was insufficient. And many times there are journals that are willing to actually forego what is actual peer review for the appearance of peer review. And it's very hard for anybody outside of the immediate research community to tell the difference. So peer review and publication does not itself solve the problem of fraud. Simultaneously, fraud is really, really corrosive, and political agendas and everything else to progress in science. So how do we deal with that? Well, I think it is embedded in some of the things that Andy said as improvements to the review process, which is make it much more open and provide multiple avenues of evaluation of research content. But trying to put a stopper of what actually gets out and is paid attention to is not going to happen. The internet occurred. Anything can get out there. And so the solution isn't how do we stop it? It's how do we improve filter? How do we provide credible mechanisms to help the public, the media, and researchers themselves evaluate whether I should take this seriously or not? And then we need to educate people about those filters particularly, so that they can become mechanisms for helping to sieve through what is a whole mess. And it's going to be a whole mess.
Yeah. Dr. Young, do you have any response to that?
I do. I certainly recognize that our peer review system that we use in the scientific literature has its flaws and limitations, and indeed, Brian's correct that there is fraudulent literature that gets past the peer review. That said, I do believe that the peer review does a reasonable job at keeping fraud out of the scientific literature. We can't always keep deliberate fraud out, but we do a pretty good job keeping the quality up. And I agree that peer review is not necessarily going to tell you if the article is the truth. It's going to tell you if it stood up to the standards when it was being performed, the research, and when it was being published. I take issue with the idea of removing, I think Brian called peer review a gatekeeper of sorts. And I I take issue with completely removing it and going to this wild west of publish anything on these preprint servers, because we do know there are frauds. We know there's hucksters. We know there are people that manipulate things for non-scientific good. And I'd ask, Brian says, by opening up the preprint, we're actually making our review process more open and transparent. In fact, I started looking through the preprint servers. They're relatively new to me, only in the past year or so. And I frankly can't find hardly any preprint articles that have any comments on them. There's a few, but not many. So I just don't believe this idea that you're getting quality feedback from your colleagues and that's going to be a substitute for the formal peer review process operated by good journals.
Thank you. So we've got several other questions that have come in. So this is from Dr. Nicholas Deutz. Does the fact that reviewers are voluntary workers induce bias toward those that have the time and energy to review? And I think, Andy, you'd be a good one to start with that one.
Undoubtedly. The busier someone is with other things, the less time they're going to have that they would be willing to volunteer to the peer review process, which is why I believe that we need to start looking at how we can compensate and incentivize peers to provide high quality peer review. We need to do a better job of incentivizing our reviewers. A voluntary system just can't do all of the things we need to do to improve the peer review enough to improve the science literature going forward.
Brian, you have a comment?
I agree with Andy's points on that there is a real resource challenge. And the additional point is that growth in the number of papers is just putting a further and further demand on reviewers. They also are uncompensated from the commercial publishers that are making record profits on their business models. This is something that we didn't follow up on from what Andy's earlier points were. The four major publishers in science are among the most profitable companies in the world. Many of them more profitable than Apple on a year-over-year basis because they have a great system where the people who create the content give them the content for free because I'm delighted to get publication. And then I ask my library to buy it back so that I can access it again. And I don't care what it costs because I don't see the costs. And so this model is fantastic business model for making lots and lots and lots of money. And it's built on the backs of free labor, of me giving my content away and the peer reviewers evaluating that content for them. And so I think there is a much more efficient business model that lowers the bar for papers being published, preprints. It is already the Wild West, right? We shouldn't be concerned about the Wild West coming because it's already here. That part's done. Anybody can publish anything on the internet. What we need are better evaluation systems, and those evaluation systems don't need to be presented in the way that we usually think of journals, but instead is peer review done by different bodies in a variety of different ways. I'm happy to talk about some of those scenarios if that's in the follow-up questions.
Great. We had a question here that, and I think, Brian, you were about to go down this route a few minutes ago, but the phrase hasn't been used, and I think it's important for the audience to hear this. This question is from Fuda Akita. What are the positions you each take on low-quality predatory journals and how it impacts scientific literature and truth? And Brian, we'll start with you on that one.
Yeah, thanks, Fuda, for that question. Predatory journals are a cancer in this system, and they emerge because of the crazy incentives that researchers face. So what a predatory journal is, essentially, is I pay, you publish, peer review doesn't happen. It is not a credible publication. So that's the simplest version. There's lots of discussion about more complex. So that's the simple version of a predatory journal. It's taking advantage of the system because I need the publication and they need the money. And so I'm willing to give it. The crazy thing about it is that the both people in this situation get what they need from it. It is predatory and corrosive on the system, but me as the author, I'm not getting taken advantage of if I get the credit of getting that publication at my institution or otherwise. And this is a very hard problem to solve because a lot of researchers and a lot of institutions don't know about which journals have these predatory practices or not. And so there's a lot of effort to try to help increase the transparency of how journals operate so that these distinctions are easier to make. But the real problem is the problem that I need the publication rather than I need the review, right? So that's why I'm suggesting that separating publication from evaluation is so critical, is that we want people to be paying attention to the evaluation as a mechanism for improving and understanding their work, not the publication. And if those are joined, we'll never get publication away as the key incentive.
Andy, would you like to address that?
I would. To me, I look at the predatory journals, indeed, I agree, they are a cancer. And we need to, but there are things out there, lists and things that can be accessed so that scientists can find out if a journal is listed as a predatory journal. But one of the key things about predatory journals is they, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like predatory journals came out on the scene in a big way about the same time we started having these article processing charges for open access. Because, I mean, what's the difference? You pay Elsevier or Nature Genetics $13,000 to publish your article there, or you pay some predatory journal some amount to publish it somewhere else. The key difference, of course, is that the quality journals are giving you a good review, or at least you hope they are. Again, notwithstanding the acknowledged limitations of the peer review system, the predatory journals aren't much different than buying open access.
All right. We are getting a bunch of questions here, and we have time to take a couple of more. And I will tell you, for all those that have given questions, if you don't get those answered, we are going to pull all those, and I'm going to give them to our speakers and ask them to write you a very short answer later on. We have one here from Charlotte Young. It says, the current peer review publication cycle certainly contains bias and favors certain voices over others. However, without a gatekeeper, to use Brian's phrase, how will articles of merit be seen and evaluated in an independent hub? Will not this further cause nepotism, bias, and amplification of the same voices, perhaps people with the connections to advocate for their work? So Charlotte is asking, will this new system with open access and with pre-review, will that not just cause amplification of the same things that we're seeing already? And Brian, we'll start with you on that one.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the most honest answer is, I don't know. We don't know how it will play out in the longer term with all of these competing interests. There is substantial risk, and I think she's right in raising that concern, that the open system may have an exclusive component that makes it more likely that the papers that people bother to read are the papers from people who are already powerful and are yet connected and in the institutions that people pay attention to, right? They use these heuristics about the individuals to decide what research pay attention to. The unknown is whether that would actually be greater or less than the system as it already exists. I have learned through where I sit now in my career versus where I was in my career at an early stage, that I have a lot more access to a lot more places where it's desirable to publish than I used to. For example, I can email the editor of the one-word journals, and the editor will answer my email. That didn't happen 20 years ago. And the fact that I can do that is power, right? I have access in a way that I have never had access. And so I am not convinced that the exclusivity of the current system is actually going to be less than what it would be if it was a more open system, where that kind of behavior is more detectable and then addressable by having different peer review services that actually, in fact, focus on redressing inequities as they occur. So thanks for that question.
Andy, do you want to jump in on that one?
Just a couple. First of all, I've never felt privileged myself with regard to my ability to reach out to journal editors. And even when I was a journal editor, my articles were frequently rejected and sent back to me. I haven't had this experience of writing Nature Genetics and having them answer my email. But that said, authors find ways to game the systems in any system. Authors that want to be published. And this probably leans to Brian's point that, you know, we're incentivizing authors to publish, not incentivizing the authors to publish high quality stuff. So we got to figure that out better. But I mean, back in the old days when we used to have double blind reviews, which were terribly difficult to actually pull off, you could never really do it. You would always cite your own stuff if you felt comfortable that reviewers would look and see, oh, this must be Dr. Young because he cited all these Young et al's and we're going to publish it. So the authors are going to game any system.
Okay. We got one last question here. We have time for one last question. We could actually, from the questions we're getting, I think we could be here most of the evening. From Gina Gorlin, and Gina, thanks for hanging and being patient with us on this one. Question for Brian. Is it possible that our science hampering incentive system might owe in part to the academic community's current philosophy of science values, for example, the tendency to prioritize hypothesis testing and confirmation over hypothesis development and discovery? And if so, could championing the latter values be some part of the solution? And Brian, we'll give you a shot at this, and then Andy will let you finish this one up.
Yeah, I think there is significant misalignment in the values that we have and aspire to for how science operates and what is actually rewarded and engaged in the system. And I think there are substantial opportunities with small tweaks to the system to really change that evaluation. Andy mentioned one of the solutions that we spend a lot of time promoting because we think it's has lots of promise in this regard, called registered reports. Right, where what the researcher is rewarded for doing. The registered reports embraces the idea that publication is going to remain the key incentive for a while. So if that's the case, then how do we shift the values for what researchers are actually rewarded for doing? Registered reports means you get peer reviewed before you know what the outcomes of the research are. So you can't be biased by the outcomes if you don't know what they are, either reviewers or the authors. So you propose the important question that you think you can investigate and the highest quality methodology you can to test that question. And that's the basis of a decision of whether to publish or not. This totally changes the orientation for everyone and is much more aligned with the values that we have, right? I am incentivized as an author to ask the most important questions I can and design the most rigorous, high quality methods I can to test them because that's what they're evaluating. The journal is evaluating based on that rather than was the result exciting? Was it unexpected? Was it all the things that make it less credible? So I do think that the shifts in, and Gina mentioned hypothesis testing otherwise, there's other kinds of shifts in the evaluation of the evidence itself where small tweaks can change fundamentally how it is we think about reward and what the evidence actually means. So thanks for that.
Great. Thank you, Brian. Andy, you want to take a little shot at that?
Maybe I might have heard the question a little bit differently. I thought perhaps that we were being asked about the value systems that are being used to evaluate the individual researchers themselves. And if indeed that's the issue, I don't believe it's fair to simply look at one aspect of a person, their publication record per se in terms of the quantity. We really have to take a whole person approach. So we've got to look at the scientist in terms of both his or her scientific contributions and accomplishments, but what else are they doing for the scientific community? Are they mentoring? Are they sharing data that other people can exploit for new science, the data that they've collected? Are they letting other people have access? There's a number of different ways to look at an individual scientist and make a judgment about their accomplishments and their performance. And certainly there's a lot of ways to judge research proposals, and looking at citations alone won't help.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Young, for that answer. And thank you all for giving us questions and answers. Again, we're going to figure out how we can get answers to the questions that we weren't able to answer tonight. And so thank you all for contributing those questions. We're going to end with a concluding statement, 5-minute concluding statements from each of the speakers. And first up is Dr. Young. And so, Dr. Young, take us away.
Well, simply put, I think that scientific journals and publishers continue to promote scientific truth and add value to the research process. I'm not nearly as negative on this as Brian is. I do believe that we need to meet the open science movement, the traditional journal publications. We need to adopt open science principles to the extent we possibly can. And I'm not talking just about commercial, but also nonprofit publishers. We need to adjust our business models. Brian pointed out how profitable some publishing companies are, but there are other publishers, particularly society publishers and university publishers, that don't make a profit. Nevertheless, they still must have recurring revenues to keep their operations moving. I think we need to definitely continue to adjust all of our procedures that improve our review processes. Speed, the nature of them, the transparency, all of those things will go a long way to making peer review more closely accomplish what it's intended to accomplish, and that is to identify what is meritorious, scientifically meritorious, and we should know about it. I don't believe we should remove the peer review as a, quote, gatekeeper, and I don't think that the anything goes on the internet is the way to go, because we see what happens with the mainstream media. And finally, I think it's very important that our journal publishers begin to adopt and provide support for both data repository and data sharing for the authors of the articles that are published in their journals. And this will certainly add value and increase the work that we can accomplish given our limited resources in science. And I think I'll just stop right there.
Great. Thank you, Andy. With the last word tonight, Dr. Nosek, and take it away.
Great. Well, thank you for this event. It was delightful to be able to have the conversation and engage with the community, first of all. As my summary point, I don't want to kill the academic publishers. I just want to break their legs to teach them a lesson. And the key, I think, is that the business models that got adopted for good reasons historically, right? We needed publishers to gather research from many different places, bind it up together, and then deliver it to other researchers to be able to access that material. And that happened through libraries, right? And then sometimes with individual subscriptions, but mostly through libraries. The subscription model worked because we needed it. We needed that publisher to do that work for us because we weren't prepared individually or even collectively as a research community to do that. Let's outsource that to the publishers. That's great. And it was functionally open access because you had to physically have access to the paper in order to read the publication. So we needed that, and if anybody can go in the library, then anybody actually had access to the literature. With the internet, the business model no longer makes sense. It no longer makes sense because science is a public good, and there's no reason that a paywall needs to be in the way of the science for the community to engage with it, to wrestle with it, to critique it, to accept it, to apply it, and everything else. So we need a business model that is aligned with the opportunity that we have to make science more available and more credible and disseminate as quickly as possible. And that is disruptive to the way that academic publishers have operated and operated very profitably. and does imply that a different model may be less profitable, but it may be also more equitable, more just, and lead us to more credible knowledge. And that's where I think we need to be pushing in open access and in open science. So thanks again for all of the time. This was a delightful event for me, so I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Brian, for that ending word. And we at the Huffines Institute want to thank both you, both Dr. Young and Dr. Nosek, for agreeing to take part in this debate. For the folks that are listening, you should understand it's not often that scientists are asked to debate live, so it takes special individuals to put themselves up front for a discussion like that. And so while I know they can't hear your applause, which is what we'd normally be doing at this point, I know that the audience is giving both of you a standing ovation at this point. I also want to thank all of the audience today for attending. In spite of our technical glitches at the beginning, I'm really excited about how this has turned out. We hope that you'll have one last chance to participate with our post-debate poll, which you'll see in a few minutes. So don't log off the webinar until you've had a chance to try to participate in that poll. Also, stay tuned because you'll see when the next Hilliard discussion, or HD11, is going to be held. Lastly, I want to recognize the Huffines staff and the individuals in the program who helped us hold this event. You'll see their pictures in a few minutes. Just know that while I've been on screen, we've had a bunch of folks working behind the screen to try to make this happen, and especially scrambling at the beginning trying to figure out why our poll wasn't working. So hang tight. I'll activate the closing PowerPoint that has the post-debate poll in it. You'll have a total about 4 minutes to participate if you can. And after you participate, feel free to close the webinar and log off. Lastly, again, thank you for coming. We hope that you all stay safe during this difficult time, stay active, and stay healthy. And we will see you in September at Hilliard Discussion 11.